good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, we're going to have a very interesting program this evening. But before we do, I wanted to comment on the 60-minute program that was aired last evening. It was about the death of Alexander Litvinenko, and he was a former member of the KGB, 20 years, a lieutenant colonel in the KGB, and who had actually been told to kill one of the oligarchs, a man, the Brezhnevsky, or something very, very similar to that, a billionaire. And he did not do that. He and his wife escaped to Great Britain, where Berezovsky, or whatever his name is living now under the protection of the British government. And then Litvinenko went ahead and he wrote a book, along with a man named Yuri Felsitsinsky, entitled Blowing Up Russia. Now, that part of the story was not mentioned at all last night, because what the blowing up Russia was really all about was that Putin, Vladimir Putin, had the KGB, or they have a new name now, I think they call them the FSB, blow up three apartment houses in Moscow, killing at least 300 Russians, and then blamed the blowing up the apartment houses on the Chechnyans to justify going to war with Chechnya. Now, that was totally deleted from the program last night, yet it was an important part of the story, and we actually have done a number of interviews with Yuri, who co-wrote the book along with Alexander Litvinenko. But, of course, the thrust of the story was Putin is going back to the old Stalinist ways, which I think he is, and that they are killing people in Russia today who disagree with the government, which I think they are. They mentioned a number of people who'd been killed. In fact, they mentioned that they had actually initially shown the program on 60 Minutes last fall, and since then, two of the people that they'd actually interviewed had been killed. Two of the people who appeared in the initial interview had been killed since then, and I believe both of them are right here in the United States, or one was in the United States, one was in Great Britain. So basically we're getting the idea that Russia is going back to its totalitarian ways, which I believe is absolutely true. But this evening our guest is Dr. Joseph Douglas, and we're going to be talking about the Communist-Capitalist Alliance that has existed going all the way back to the time of the Russian Revolution, which no one in our government would ever talk about, and that is that people in our government have worked closely with people in the Soviet government since the time of the Communist Revolution. Dr. Joseph Douglas has worked with intelligence for many years. He's retired now. He's a personal friend back in the Washington, D.C. area, lives in Virginia, but he has a lot of contacts with people back there. He's written extensively on the drug issue, on the men we abandoned, American soldiers abandoned in Vietnam. But we're going to talk about the Communist Capitalist Alliance this evening. Dr. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, I'd like to get your view on this, because we'd never talked about it until just the other day evening when I was asking about another subject. You said you were rather interested in this subject.
Very much so. It's one that I seem to keep coming back to. I get away from it and I just keep coming back to it every year.
All right, fine. We're going to get then. We're going to explore that this evening, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, you pick this story up.
Well, I guess the reason I keep coming back to it is every time you take a look at almost any dimension of the, let's say, the conflict between capitalism and communism, you come to the conclusion that they would have lost any number of times had it not been for the collusion of the capitalists.
In other words, the communists would have collapsed.
Absolutely. And so how can there be a war between the two if over all of the ages we are doing our darndest to help them, or Britain is doing their darndest, or Germany, or all of Europe, and yet you have it still portrayed as a war? And indeed, when you look at it from the Soviet eyes, I don't think there's any question, but it is a war in their mind to bring us down, to destroy us. Yet we're keeping them alive all the time. You know, how do you really square that with the other aspect of the story?
Well, could you give our listeners a few examples of how the West has helped communism through the years?
Oh, my goodness. Certainly. Right at the beginning, when Russia was formed, which was not a revolution, it was a coup. It was basically financed by people from the West, particularly from the United States. Now, before that coup took place, Russia had some very good industries, and they were able to care for their own people. They had good agriculture. They were manufacturing cars and planes and doing all sorts of things back then. But then, when the communists took over, that all ended. And by 1921-22 time frame, they had massive starvation growing, and industry had not been able to do anything to get started again. And I guess because nobody wanted to work for the communist government, because, you know, they owned everything, they took everything. And what happened then? Well, two things. You had tremendous amount of assistance given by the United States. Some 700 tons of food were shipped in, as I recall, and a lot of the industrialists came in to get the industry moving again, and the Germans came in droves to help turn on the industry switches that had been turned off for 3 years. And so they got the industry moving back again, and then you get into the 30s, and they were still, you know, on the verge of another starvation. And
Joe, are you on a regular hardline telephone? We're just sort of fading in out just a little bit.
Yes, I am.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Joe Douglas. And he was just saying that immediately after the Russian Revolution, the Russians just couldn't get anything done. The communists couldn't get anything accomplished. And had it not been for the fact that the Germans and the Americans moved in with massive aid to the communists, not to the anti-communists, but to the communist government, the communists would have fallen. But, of course, it was the help of massive aid from America that stabilized the communist regime, and yet the communists were constantly talking about the necessity of overthrowing capitalism and how one day, the capitalists were going to be destroyed. And yet here are the capitalists helping the communists. And, of course, it really doesn't make any sense. And yet, if you look at the history of that time and read many of the books that certainly are discussed in some of my recent newsletters at RadioLiberty.com, and we give you the exact sources where you can get the information, it's very obvious that the West was helping communism starting in 1918. So pick the story up there, Dr. Douglas.
And you had the same thing came along also in the 1930s, Dr. Stan, as you recall. The Soviet Union was broke. They were bankrupt. And the United States pulled their chestnuts out of the fire then again by recognizing them diplomatically. And, of course, that then opened the floodgates for other nations to come in and lend them money and start trade with them. And then you get into World War II in the 40s, and they had killed off so many of their senior officers that Hitler probably would not have had much of a trouble in subduing the country, which may have been why he attacked in the first place. And the only thing that saved them then was a fabulous amount of lend-lease that came over to Russia. Not only in military aid and assistance, but manufacturing and all sorts of products.
In fact, we sent entire factories over there so that they could actually begin to not only do manufacture, during the war, trucks and cars but they could use those same factories immediately after the war to rebuild Russia after the havoc of World War II.
Yeah, basically, we gave them about $11 billion worth of materiel, and that's back when about $11 billion in today's money would probably be closer to a couple hundred billion.
Right.
So a massive amount of help. And then we got into the 50s, and that's when the Cold War really started to break out. And there was all sorts of concern about Russia being an enemy. But, of course, then they operated another one of their deceptions, which was to wave the flag of peaceful coexistence. And what happened? First thing you had is all the European countries starting to give aid and assistance, and then the United States passing more laws to give aid and assistance to Eastern Europe and then to the Soviet Union, and just continued to grow and grow and grow. There was so much aid coming in from the West, as a matter of fact, that they had a problem with inflation in the early 1960s and had to cut back on things. But you've had this practice that keeps going along. You have somebody that from all appearances is a death enemy of ours, lethal. And we keep, as Anthony Sutton said in his excellent books on the subject, we proceeded to build the best enemy money could buy. And never did it ever change the Russians. Everybody always said, well, ignore what they're doing because they'll really follow our lead, and they'll come to agree that they really need to join the network of nations. And that never happened, never took place.
Well, what really always disturbed me most was during the Vietnam War. That was buried between about 64 and, of course, 74. When, of course, the Russians were the major source of military equipment for the North Vietnamese, why the American government was funding and giving military technology and building the truck plants and the Fiat plants and all of these things for Russia, that was supplying the military supplies to the North Vietnamese, who were supplying the supplies to the South Vietnamese, who were killing our boys in the rice paddies and villages of South Vietnam. Now, why would we be funding and helping and financing the people who were financing our enemies? That just didn't make sense, and certainly Professor Sutton had written about that in his book, and you'll see the entire text of his testimony before the Republican Platform Committee in 1972 during the Vietnam War, or it's in my March newsletter posted on the web at RadioLiberty.com, the entire testimony that Professor Sutton gave, pointing out just what I said. How we were financing the people who were financing the North Vietnamese, who were financing the Viet Cong, who were killing our boys. And instead of anybody being incensed by that, there was immediate vicious attack on Professor Sutton, and he told me that when he got back to the Hoover Institute after going to testify why his name was taken off his door of his office at the Hoover Institute, his telephone was disconnected. He was banished to a basement room, and he could never get another job working at any one of the universities in the United States after that. It takes an awful lot of power to be able to keep a very accomplished researcher and professor from getting a job, but that was what the establishment did to Professor Sutton, because he dared to point out that, of course, what really happened in Vietnam was a scam.
That's true, and of course, that brings in a very important feature of this whole alliance, which has been on the Western side always remaining silent about the crimes of communism, and indeed doing your best to cover those crimes up, to create a false image of the Soviet Union, to sort of pretend that it was the same as we were, and to seek revenge and all sorts of punishment for anybody who dared to break that silence and tried to tell the truth, as Dr. Sutton did.
In fact, there is a wonderful article. It was in the Congressional Record, I think it was 1975, It was a speech that was given by Alexander Solzhenitsyn to the AFL conference, AFL-CIO conference that year. And, you know, it was the most amazing thing. In fact, every reference to that speech that he gave, you know, it was printed as a congressional record. But when they printed the congressional record, they gave the wrong date so that, at least when people quoted it, oh, you could never find it. And we did find it. We at least printed part of it there. And I think it was in my April newsletter. It was called the Communist Capitalist Alliance. And that's what Solzhenitsyn was talking about. And he never understood why we would be helping the communists who were so ruthless and had killed so many millions of people in their ruthless effort to destroy freedom in his country. But he knew that it happened. He just didn't understand why.
Yeah, he couldn't see why, you know, if the United States was an enemy of communism, and goodness knows we should be, and he thought we were, but then we would go to all sorts of lengths to provide the Soviet Union with all the weapons and surveillance and technology they needed to watch their own citizens, which meant putting them into the gulag, throwing them into jail for life. And he just could not understand that. And that's what they were doing. So they were wreaking out all these crimes on their own people. This excellent Black Book of Communism that came out in 1997 in France and in the United States in 1999, which was trying to document all the crimes. And while they short-sighted the crimes in Russia, they still came up with something like 100 million. Now, of deaths caused in their own people by the various communist leaders. Now, it should have been more like about 160 million, but even coming up with 100 million was quite an accomplishment for them, particularly since the researchers were all former communists or close fellow travelers themselves. But what they ignored also in the book was the fact that they were not just wreaking havoc on their own people. They were also wreaking havoc on the rest of the world. Not just the building of weapons and all that sort of imagery that they conjured up, but they had tremendous intelligence operations going, mostly directed primarily against the United States, because we were the main enemy, which has just been taking a tremendous toll on people over here. There's not one family that has not suffered tremendously from the drug trade. And that came about through the Soviet beginnings of that as an intelligence operation in 1955. And it's been tremendously trying on the people, yet, you know, not one in a thousand people would understand that that came from a Soviet intelligence operation.
And it was really a conscious effort to corrupt our society, wasn't it?
Yes, particularly the youth, because they knew that if the youth used drugs, that when they grew up, they would be weak leaders. And that's what they wanted to achieve, was to the corruption of the youth and to prevent them from being strong leaders as they grew up. And in terms of corrupting the elite, they used a slightly different approach because they knew that people really didn't voluntarily go to drugs, recreational drugs, as they got older. You know, that's one of the things we learned. If you keep people off of drugs and even tobacco until they're about 25, chances are very good that they won't get involved with that stuff, because the brain really doesn't end its growth until about that age, and particularly in terms of the decision-making capability. Now, up to that age, we're sort of invulnerable, and nothing can stop us. But during that last five-year period, we learn that there are things you don't take, and drugs is one of them. So to corrupt the elite, they went to organized crime, targeted directly at the elite who had a lot of interest in money and were really tied into organized crime, particularly the political elite and the banking industry.
And of course, the Russians have always worked, the communists have always worked in this country to corrupt us from within. And realizing, of course, if you could corrupt the country, why you wouldn't have to defeat it anymore? Why, of course, we would simply be incapable of fighting when push came to shove. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll pick the story up there, Joe.
Well, I agree with you, Dr. Stan. They just they work hard at this indirect warfare. And while we looked at all the missiles, at least the ones we could see, and the media would give a good publicity to the missiles, that really served more than anything else as a distraction. It took our attention away from what was really happening and where the silence really came in. And that was where the government would not tell anybody what was happening about the drugs, about organized crime and where that was coming from, and also about international terrorism, because the Soviets were the granddaddy of today's international terrorism, particularly the Middle East terrorism. But nobody would touch that until the 1980s, when they started recognizing it as a result of a number of books that were written in about 1980-81. But then, of course, the Soviets came back and did another one of their disappearing acts in 1989 to 1991 to convince us of the fact that, well, they've turned over a new leaf because they decided they couldn't survive very well in the way they were going.
Then they changed the name of the KGB to the FSB and supposedly they got rid of all the communists. Only, of course, they were still communists, but now they call them the oligarchs.
Yes, and, you know, again, a terrifically good example of the attitude of the West. You have a changeover taking place. You have a lot of confusion because not everybody knows what's happening over there. It was the perfect time to collect some decent intelligence on the ground. And what did we do? By direct orders from the White House, all intelligence collection toward the Soviet Union was cut off to the extent they could. They just chopped it right and left. They closed safe houses for defectors that might come out. They stopped electronic surveillance on the ground, communications intercepts in that area. Even the DDO was so amazed, he wrote about it later on, Milton Bearden, and indicated that that happened. And so as a result, we, at the very time that we should have doubled or tripled or quadrupled our intelligence effort toward Soviet Union and Russia, we cut it back to nearly nothing. And as a result, we had no intelligence coming in on what was happening. For example, how they were changing over, how these various activities, such as the narcotics trafficking, organized crime, were adjusting and taking on a new form, or how terrorism was now taking on a new form of sponsorship so that it wouldn't be as obvious what was happening. We missed all that. We missed the fact that Al-Qaeda was growing up and with strong financial ties to the Soviet Union. We missed the fact, or to Russia then. We missed the fact that the deputy deputy under bin Laden was a long-time Soviet agent in terrorism down in Egypt. And on the traffic goes.
You're talking about al-Zawahiri.
Yes. So they're an enemy, and all of a sudden we're assisting them, we're throwing billions of dollars at them, and are they changing? No, their intelligence has been stepped up in the United States. Have they changed in terms of what they do militarily? Some, they've cut back some forces in the conventional area, but in terms of the core, no, they didn't change. They keep on building new weapons and new nuclear missiles, and most frightening from my perspective is they have a massive operation underway in the biological area.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Douglas was simply saying that after the fall of communism, when we certainly should have stepped up our intelligence so we'd know everything that was going on in Russia, and we'd try to influence it and bring about a truly free society with the right of people to, you know, have the same freedoms we do here, all of this stopped, and we stopped our intelligence gathering, we stopped our monitoring, we really almost stopped everything that would have allowed us to have really won the Cold War. The KGB simply changed its name. The same people kept working there. Certainly, the government had always been under the control of the KGB. And, of course, now Putin comes in, Said the Gelson was the only person going all the way back to Khrushchev who had not come from the KGB. All the rest of them, after Khrushchev did, and now of course Putin comes from the KGB. He was the head of the KGB, as was Andropov, as was Chertov, as were all of these people. They were all came from the KGB. The KGB controls and rules Russia today, and yet we're doing everything we can to build up Russia. And it just doesn't make sense. Of course, Dr. Douglas is pointing out that Russia, you know, is building new nuclear weapons and new types of military. Russia is helping, the Muslim extremists. In fact, although he didn't mention it, certainly Russia is providing very sophisticated weapons for Iran and for Syria. That will be used in the next war, and I fear will be used against American forces there. And what is so fascinating, what I did an interview with Yuri Felshtinsky, who was the co-author of the book Bombing Russia, along with Alexander Litvinenko. Felshtinsky said, and he said this three times, because I interviewed him three times, he said, you go an hour outside of either St. Petersburg and Moscow, and you're in the 19th century. You're in the 19th century. He's talking about 1800s Russia. And I kept thinking afterwards, why is he saying that? What is he really telling me? And what he's telling me is that outside of the major cities where you have modernization and industrialization, nothing has changed. I mean, you have almost the same feudal society in Russia in the rural areas that you had, 150 years ago. How could this be? I mean, I thought Russia was a first-rate nation, and yet I don't believe it is at all. I believe that's what we're supposed to believe. I believe most of what we believe just isn't true.
I think you're absolutely right there. And, of course, that's another example of people actually promoting false images of the Soviet Union, a great example of being medicine. They were supposed to be way ahead in medicine, doing great things with wonderful health care for the United States, for all their citizens. And then when all of a sudden the doctors started going over there, they found out that they had one needle that had to last for a whole week in a hospital because that's all they had. And it was just atrocious. Everything was a scam that we were given to believe. And
the average man there dies at age 58. Now, here in the United States, the average man lives to 78. In Russia, he dies at 58. Is this a sign of a first-rate nation? They always tell us, oh, that's because they drink too much. Well, they may drink too much, but a lot of people here drink too much, too, and they're not dying at 58 years of age. So something else is going on over there. There are far more people in caskets over there than they're in the cradles. Their population is dying off because of their birth control programs. In fact, they're doing everything they can to get couples to have children, because they realize the population is dying off. So something seriously wrong with what we're being told about Russia, yeah, and being this first-rate nation.
And it's not that this was not known to people who traveled over there. Those on tours would often be given the Potemkin villages to look at. But I remember talking with Dr. William Scott and Harriet Scott. Bill Scott was a defense attaché there on two tours in Moscow, and Harriet was a specialist in the languages she made herself into, and did a lot of excellent translations of the military literature. But they went around as much as they could, and we had many discussions, and what they always said is, paved roads are just in a couple of show cities. The minute you go 25 miles outside of Moscow, it's dirt, and you're gone back 100 years in time. Just a feudal society out there. But the Soviets don't care anything whatsoever about their people or any other people for that matter. And again, this is what Solzhenitsyn had in mind, why he was so mad at the United States. Here we were doing things to keep communism alive and thus would enable the people to rise up and take over and get rid of this yoke. But we made it impossible for them because of our economic and military and technical assistance to the Soviet Union.
Well, that thought will be right back. this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, this raises the real question today. We know, of course, if Russia is really so backward, how is it she's able to create very sophisticated weapons that she can give to Iran and to Syria? If Russia is so backward today, how is it that Russia is today the largest exporter of oil and of natural gas in the world, and has, of course, all sorts of pipelines going into Western Europe, which allows her to have tremendous, access to the European markets? And Russia has reserves, federal reserves, government reserves, of over $410 billion. The United States reserves are El Zippo. We have no reserves. The United States is having to borrow $2 to $3 billion every single day to pay its debts, and yet the Americans are still managing, under one guise or another, to funnel money into Russia. And Russia is saying, we don't want America coming over here and having, influencing our policies, and yet we're giving them massive amounts of money when they have far more in the way of reserves than we do. Doesn't make sense, Joe.
Absolutely not. I mean, exactly the time that we could see the cost of oil going through the roof as well is when we started providing all the subsidies to explore the oil well fields, to build them up, to develop them, and to get those fuel supplies out to Europe, which then the Soviets use to keep alive through all the revenue that they make, and the gas, which gives them also tremendous economic leverage over those countries. Aren't we nice?
Well, because I don't know if you had a chance to read my my last two newsletters, but we go into the background of where the Russians got all of their money to actually drill the new oil wells, where the Russians got the money to build all their new gas wells, and who is funding this massive network of pipelines throughout Russia and into Western Europe. And of course, it's all the United States and our allies in Europe. And why would the Europeans want to make themselves dependent on Russia for natural gas and for a source of energy? There are a lot of questions here that really don't make sense. And I hope that we can spend a little time, of course, talking about that and trying to get people to begin to question, because nothing is it appears to be. And if nothing is appears to be, then there has to be another explanation. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Joe Douglas. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas. And before we go on, Joe, do you have a website? And how can people get your books? We do carry your book for trade, the story of the young men who we abandoned in Vietnam. But you also have the book Red Cocaine. And do you have any other books?
Probably the easiest way is just to go to Amazon on the Internet and search on my name. I have published about 12 books. Now that the Soviet Union is our good friend, most of them are going out of print since they dealt with the Soviet Union as the enemy, but they deal with the details on what the Soviet nuclear strategy was really all about, and also where terrorism came from, particularly in chemical and biological warfare. We had a book that came out in 1988, a little bit too early, talking about the biological and chemical threat to the United States. And Red Cocaine is still available, and that's available through Amazon or through the publisher, which is edwardharl.com. So the easiest way is just either through the book publishers or the bookstores that can usually order Red Cocaine, or you have Betrayed there on...
Well, we carry Betrayed. We think it's an excellent, very, very good book.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple of things that struck me in reading the selections of these ones on the Capitalism-Communism Alliance.
You're speaking of my newsletters?
Yes. And there are three examples that I thought I'd add in here that came to me from General Jan Sena. And for your readers' information, he was the highest-ranking defector ever to come to the United States. the only one who was actually a member of the decision-making hierarchy. And he had a fabulous memory, and he knew what was happening, and he was on social terms with all the top communist leaders around the world. He interacted with them tremendously because he was part of the decision-making hierarchy. And when in 1965-66, they were making so much money on their new drug operation that they had to revise their money laundering operations. And he said, you know, Joe, we needed to revamp the whole money laundering operation, and that was eye-opening because we didn't do it, and the KGB didn't do it. It was done for us by international finance. And we just got the names of the banks and the people at the banks who had already had the security checks run on them and told to use those banks to move the money through. And that they did. And it was all set up by the international Western capitalists, the peak of the capitalists.
In other words, this was how they were going to launder their money that they were getting through the illegal drug trade?
That's right.
Well, did General Senya have any serious question in his mind why this was happening? Because, you know, just as Solzhenitsyn could never figure out why people in the West were helping the communists, so that I would assume that Senya, who having defected to the West because he chose freedom rather than tyranny, would have wondered that, but why are the Westerners, why are the Western banks helping the communists, who certainly are their enemy? Doesn't make sense.
You know, I'm not sure that he understood that, because the things he said, I think he would have continued and said more about them. And I made the mistake at the time of jotting down what he said, but in not pursuing it, because there were so many things to pursue that wasn't high on my agenda at the time. But what he said is really extremely provocative. What he said was, he said that, and he told me this on two occasions, Dr. Stan, told me that never was there a decision made in Moscow that international finance was not present.
Never was there a decision made in Moscow when international finance was not present. And I think that that is pretty well the common thread that you can see followed all the way back to the time of the Russian Revolution, and in a book written by Bruce Lockhart, who had been sent to Russia to keep an eye on Lenin by Lord Milner, who was, of course, intimately involved with banks and, of course, with Cecil Rhodes Secret Society back in 1918. And Bruce Lockhart, in this book, Imperial Asia, and I quote part of it in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, couldn't understand why Lenin would always come to him and a fellow named Robbins, who was actually, you know, an agent of a man named Thompson, who was associated with the Federal Reserve Board, and Raymond Robbins and Bruce Lockhart were always there being consulted by Lenin before Lenin made any major move. And Lockhart couldn't understand that, why Lenin was so subservient to this Raymond Robbins and to his mentor with the Federal Reserve Bank in New York City.
And it hasn't changed in 70 years. It was still going on. And it really tells you who's really running the show. Not the details, but who is behind the works.
And go right ahead.
One of the other aspects, a third point that he brought out. Now, in his capacity as secretary, and running the secretary to the defense council, he had one department which took care of what were the special villas. It's a nice house on a quiet street. You might call them a safe house, but they were a little bit more luxurious than that. But this is where a number of very key and secret meetings were always held. And the defense council had about a dozen of those, and there were about five in their defense ministry that also had them for such meetings. And he was chief of staff to the Minister of Defense. And the administrative organs department, probably the most powerful department of the communist system, and he was a secret member of that as a result of his position in the military, where he was the first secretary at the Ministry of Defense, and they had several, and he was aware of those. And and he did a lot, spent a lot of time monitoring these and coordinating activities between them, because sometimes they have so many meetings going on that they have to be aware of other houses that one agency could lend to the another agency. And he said that second thing he said about the international finance and the communist system was that never was there a week went by that there were not secret meetings held in their villas between international finance and KGB and Russian officials and Czech officials. And he said they met in Prague because none of the people in the financial area wanted to be seen going into Moscow. And so it was much better, and there was all good reasons to go to Prague, which was a victim, and not a bad Russian. And so people sort of ignored what was happening in Prague. And that's where so many of these meetings held place every week between the various capitalists in the West and the intelligence services and key leaders in the communist countries. And another very interesting piece of that capitalist-communist alliance.
Well, we actually have the opportunity to speak to a man named Bukovsky, who is certainly really probably as well known, at least in Russia, as Solzhenitsyn was. Bukovsky lives over in London today, and but he actually had an opportunity of going to Russia, right after the thaw back in 1989. He's written a little book we carry called EUSSR, and in that book he tells what some of the records they were able to get from the Soviet archives, pointing out, I think it was about 1989 when Khrushchev when Gorbachev was still in power. And who should go over to Moscow but members of the Trilateral Commission? And so there was, I believe, there was Kissinger and Rockefeller and two or three others of the similar ilk there. And whether Brzezinski was there or not, I'm not certain. But they told Gorbachev he was going to have to go along with the EU, with the European Union. The European Union was going to be formed, and he was going to have to accept the fact that they were going to be the dominant force in Europe, and that's just the way that it was. And here were the people from the Trilateral Commission meeting with the head of an independent state, telling him exactly what was going to happen and what he was to do. And as we actually carry this, Bukovsky certainly was wondering what this was all about. But it was significant enough that he put this into a little book, which we do carry, called the EUSSR, and certainly written by a man who certainly has an international reputation as a staunch anti-communist, having served his time in the Soviet Gulag and been released in return for the release of a member of the KGB. Bukovsky is certainly one of the leading anti-communists of Western Europe today, and of course he feels that the EU, the European Union, is simply the Sovietization of Europe, just as those of us here in North America feel that the North American Union, which George Bush is so intent upon establishing, is simply the Sovietization of the Northern Hemisphere here, and bring us under a very, very similar form of government, which doesn't make sense, but then so much of what goes on doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. And another good example of that doesn't make any sense, and you really have to stop and think about it and rethink it over. But you recall the Reese Committee investigation of tax-exempt foundations?
Oh, well, I do, and of course, as you know, we do carry the book.
Oh, yes.
The foundations, their power and influence, and incidentally, the entire text of the 2,000 pages of the Reese Committee findings are now up on the Internet. Charlotte Isabey has put them in. They're up there, and you can get them or they pull them all down. First time they've ever been available on the Internet. And, why don't you tell our listeners what the Reese Committee found about communism?
Well, what the Reese Committee found really was that the 12 largest foundations in the United States, tax-exempt foundations, that controlled at that time, 1954, 80% of all the foundation's assets, were spending those assets really to undermine our democracy and our way of life and our culture and our beliefs, that they were in the process of through the education system, of replacing all notions of Republican, the Republic as designed by our founding fathers, and getting rid of all those concepts and replacing them with collectivism, socialism, and communist concepts.
And they were actually financing the communist movement here in the United States and in other countries that helped. They were instrumental in influencing American policy to bring communism to China back, you know, in the 1949-1950 era, which didn't make sense. And that's what they found.
Makes no sense at all. And it's really the key on it was when the head of the research for the committee, Norman Dodd, went up to talk with Rowan Gaither, who was then the president of the Ford Foundation. And Mr. Gaither had invited him up, because he knew he was doing this study, to come to his New York office and talk to him about it. And so Dodd couldn't believe his ears. And so he said, "Well, yes, I'll be up tomorrow." And so he took the train up to New York, and he came in to Mr. Gaither's office, and almost before Dodd could say anything, Gaither said, "Well, I understand you're doing a study of tax-exempt foundations like we have." And
now, this is the Ford Foundation, Rowan Gaither of the Ford Foundation.
And, yes, one of the largest ones. And Dodd said, "Well, yes, I am." He says, "Well, would you like to know what we're doing and where the directives that we follow come from?" And Dodd couldn't believe his ears. And he said, "Well, yes." And he said, "Well, it's off the record," he says, "but we operate on directives that come from the White House. And all of us here have been connected with the government in the past, and either in the European Commissions or the OSS, and we operate on these directives. And would you like to know what those directives said?" And Dodd continues, "Please, don't stop, continue." And Gaither said, "Well, under those directives, we are to employ our grant-making ability so as to so change life in the United States that will make comfortable the merger between the Soviet Union and the United States." Now, this is 1954. This is when the Cold War was really hot, when everybody was worried about communism and communists in the government, when the communists were clearly our enemies. And you have to ask now, who would ever want to have a merger between the United States and the Soviet Union?
Well, because maybe the truth of the matter, that communism wasn't really the enemy. We were supposed to believe communism was the enemy to justify the massive taxation, the massive government control over the lives of the American people, the massive American military that the Americans were developing to counter the communists. And we were supposedly the enemy, but maybe nothing as it appeared to be. And that, of course, I think is what's so important for people to understand. Everything is illusion and delusion.
That's right. And when you think about it, making a merger between the United States and the Soviet Union comfortable captures the essence of the problem involved in creating a new world order,
right,
globalism. Why would you have a nation that is tremendously prosperous and with all sorts of good truths and beliefs and wonderful homes want to merge with a country that's still operating in the feudal age? And the answer was, of course you wouldn't. And so how do you have to change life here? What are you going to do to make this possible? And from what I can see, there's several things that you have to do. Number one, you have to destroy the United States. You have to cut it down to size, destroy its economy, destroy the Christian beliefs of the people, destroy their faith in their government. You have to cut the United States down to size so that we want, more than anything else, to join with somebody else to find safety and security somehow. And then the second thing you have to do is you have to hide the crimes of communism. You have to paint an image of the rest of the world so that they look as better, as good as we are, if not better, so that there's a place, a group of people that we want to merge in. And, of course, that's the image that they were trying to paint of the Soviet Union. And they had people that, in all the foundations that they found out in their studies, that they had hired, they had taken their own crop of historians because the real historians wouldn't do it. And they sent them over to London to get specially trained so that they could rewrite all of the history of the United States that would deprecate our founding fathers, our ideas, our beliefs, and they pushed all that stuff into the public schools along with the communist philosophy.
And this is why our young people today, so many of them come out of school dedicated to socialism, believing, of course, that government can solve all of our problems. Our guest has been Dr. Joe Douglas, and we're talking about the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. Now, I'd like to suggest that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Western civilization, it will be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. Well, Joe, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Stan, I can think of no better way to wrap it up than to say these three parts on the Communist-Capital Alliance that you have put out are just wonderful. And I hope everybody, if they don't have copies of them, will get copies and pass them around to as many people as they can, because this tells us what is happening, and you're not going to find it in your textbooks, you're not going to find it in the newspapers, and you're not going to find it in any of the magazines that are you buy for sale in the store. Yet it's so critical to understand, one of the most important things to understand, to really understand the threat we face, which is not just external.
Amen to that. Well, there's obviously another agenda here, and this is explored in those three letters. Of course, they're available from Radio Liberty, and when we get back in just a moment, we'll tell you how to get those. I appreciate your kind words, and I think that it's so vitally important that people understand what's going on, because much of this we've taken from other people. In fact, our latest newsletter, we actually had borrowed in large part from something Dan Smoot had written back in 1962. He recognized what was going on. Professor Sutton recognized what was going on. Solzhenitsyn recognized what was going on. Bukowski recognized what was going on. But they could not connect all of the dots because there is something major missing in our interpretation of what's going on. This is what we've tried to do, is put it all together into a sequence people can really understand.
And the Communist-Capitalist Alliance is one of those things that is missing 99.9% of the time.
Well, our job is to try to get people to think, to question, and to hopefully more and more of them will begin realizing that behind everything that's going on are powerful spiritual forces, because if we look at this from a purely logical point of view, it doesn't make sense. If it doesn't make sense, there must be another explanation. And, of course, if you have a deep religious belief, as I know Joe does and I do, you realize, of course, that God does work in the affairs of men, and also there are satanic forces at work in the affairs of men. And we have to look at the plans of both of these organizations, both of these groups, as we view unfolding history to make any sense out of what appears to be otherwise insane. So, Joe, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, and we'll look forward to perhaps we could do the program again on one of our other networks.
Thanks very much, Stan, because this is a topic that is just so important. When I saw your papers, I had to call you.
God bless, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was certainly pleased when Dr. Douglas called and we had an opportunity to talk about my last four newsletters. They're available on the Internet, March, April, May, and June newsletters. They certainly are up there free. You're welcome to pull them down if you'd like to get them in pamphlet form. We'll be putting them in pamphlet form for you so that you can pass them out and so you can get them to others. We are running out of time. We have to get people to begin thinking. And, of course, when you look and see the history of the past, and you realize, of course, that the reason that Russia today is the largest producer of oil and natural gas is because of massive infusions of aid from the United States, primarily from the United States, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Export-Import Bank, the Asian Development Bank, etc., etc., American banks, American corporations, American oil companies, and the American government. You need to go to RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com and pull down those newsletters. And as I say, if you'd like to get them in pamphlet form, they are available, will be available from Radio Liberty. And this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America with the information you're not going to get elsewhere. So we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will certainly want to get some of the books we carry, or my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, Professor Sutton's books, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, my interview with Professor Sutton, and it's available on video, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, and then, of course, we do carry The Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and you need to understand the history of how America has helped the communists since the time of the Russian Revolution. So begin asking yourself why things are happening. Don't take anything for granted. Why did Sidney, the president, look into Putin's eyes and see his soul and tell us that that we could trust him? When, of course, he was a member of the KGB. Why would George Bush make a statement like that? And now why is, of course, the Russians are beginning to act like the Russians traditionally have? Why are we financing the Russians, who are financing the Iranians and the Syrians and giving them the weapons that are going to be used against American soldiers and against Israel in the coming war that is going to be expanding in the Middle East? Why are we going to expand the war? Why do we want to keep our troops in Iraq? We're not going to pull our troops out. We may pull some of them out, but the plan is to keep our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. And anybody who tells you that's not true just is not being forthright with you. In fact, President Bush and some of our generals have admitted we plan to keep our troops there permanently. Is that why we went in? Did they lie to us why we went in? Or all the men who fought in blood and died there? They seem to have been used like the people were in Vietnam when we were told there was a Gulf of Tonkin incident, and there wasn't one, and 58,000 American boys died fighting a war that was totally unnecessary, a war that America lost on purpose because we were funding, the Russians were funding the North Vietnamese, were funding the South Vietnamese, who were killing American boys. Just as today in Pakistan and Afghanistan, we fund the Pakistani government that funds the Pakistani intelligence, that funds the Taliban, that is killing American boys in the poppy fields and villages of Afghanistan. It's deja vu all over again, ladies and gentlemen, but nobody wants to tell you that. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free catalog, free newsletter, we'd love to get it to you if you haven't had them before. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, well, this evening we're hoping to have with us Johanna Michelson. And those of you who do not know Johanna, Johanna was a medium, and she had the supernatural gift of being able to contact the other dimension. And when she was a young woman living in Mexico, she was actually recruited to become a psychic healer. And she attended many sessions with this woman, this older Mexican woman, who could perform these truly supernatural surgical feats. She could reach into somebody's head and pull out a tumor. Now, how do you reach into somebody's head and pull out a tumor? I mean, in the material world we live in, that sort of thing cannot happen. But in the other dimension, all sorts of things can happen. And Johanna was really so taken with this, and she was thrilled to think that one day she too would be able to carry out these miraculous feats, and people would come from all over Mexico, indeed all over the Western Hemisphere, for these treatments. And of course most of them were actually cured, or appeared to be cured of the terrible inflictions that they had. And then her sister, Johanna's sister, kept telling her that this was demonic, this was not of God. And but Johanna said, how could this not be of God? This is wonderful, these things are happening. And of course, what happened, of course, was that eventually Johanna went off to Switzerland and spent some time there with Francis Schaeffer, and eventually came to realize that what she was witnessing truly was supernatural, but it was not of God. Well, right now, to our good friend, Johanna Michelson. Hi, Johanna, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Dr. Stan. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Well, have we got the phone worked out?
Well, no, not really very well. I've got a problem with the unit I usually use. It is giving me a very difficult time.
Well, let's just, this one sounds pretty good, so let's go. And I just sort of introduced you. I'm going to let you pick up the ball and run with it.
Well, what are we picking up and where are we running?
Well, you just told me you wanted to talk about the things we've talked about in the past, your supernatural experiences there in Mexico, and then where this has all led you, realizing that there is another dimension. There's a spiritual dimension that most people do not recognize. And you, of course, experienced this when you were a young woman in Mexico and working with as sort of a sorcerer's apprentice.
All right.
Go ahead.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's good to be with you tonight. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the nature of deception since we spoke last, and there is such a massive, overwhelming preponderance of evidence that indeed we are, I firmly believe, living at the very end of the end times, those times of which Jesus himself spoke when he was asked what would be the signs of the end of the age and of his coming. The Lord warned us in Matthew 24, and we're all familiar, I'm sure, with the passage, most of your audience is, I'm sure, Dr. Sten, about the wars and the rumors of wars and the frightening things that we're seeing now, nation rising against nation, the earthquakes, the famines, the plagues, the betrayals. But the one sign...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Johanna, go ahead.
But the one sign, Dr. Stan, that Jesus mentioned not once, not twice, but three times, was a warning about spiritual deception. He said to his people, "See to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ who will mislead many. And then he tells us in verse 11 that many false prophets would arise and would indeed mislead many. And then in case we didn't get it the first two times around, he tells us again that false Christs and false prophets would arise and would show great signs and wonders so as to mislead even the elect. And I believe firmly, Dr. Stan, that we're seeing that. You know, I myself experienced the world of the occult and the supernatural from the time I was very young. And back when I was growing up, the story was somewhat unusual. It sadly no longer is. Countless millions of people are encountering and experiencing supernatural phenomena, the awareness of another dimension in which terrible things happen, frightening things happen, and certainly also the other side, things that seem appealing and beautiful happen. And for me, it started when I was about 11 and a half, when something moved into our home, slammed doors that my father had locked twice with the only key, stomped down the stairs, terrified the dogs, woke up my sister. My sister and I were growing up in Mexico at the time. And from that point on, Dr. Stan, something had moved into our home, which gave me an overwhelming awareness of the fact that there was a dimension that was very real but unseen, and yet a sinister terror that was as tangible as the chair I'm sitting on right now as we speak. I began to become increasingly aware of the fact that I was developing psychic abilities as I grew older, knew what people were thinking, which was rarely what they were saying, had an uncanny ability to know what was going to happen before it happened. Many of our audience I know are familiar with this. And went all through my college days being labeled a weirdo at best and a witch at worst. Weirdo I was, witch I wasn't, not by the Wiccan definition of it today, but really at a loss, Dr. Stan, because I felt at the mercy of these forces. I didn't know what to do with them. But when I got out of college, I went back to Mexico, where my father and mother were living still at the time. And my father came across an ad for...
Hold on, though. We'll be back in just a moment with Johanna Michelson. Well, this is Dr. Stan. You go right ahead, Mike and Johanna.
My father came across an ad for a group in Mexico, in Cuernavaca, called Silva Mind Control. Today they call it the Silva Method. And it's one of many different mind control or mind development groups, psychic development groups, which was teaching us to develop the genius potential of the brain, supposedly. And what they were doing, basically, Dr. Stan, was teaching us how to become psychics and how to get our spirit guide. Sadly, it's the same kind of thing that a lot of the kids in our school systems are learning this very day, and even in a lot of the Christian schools, and what a lot of people, even in the church, are learning how to do. And we'll be talking about that as we go along. But when I got involved with this mind control group, Dr. Stan, I felt really as though God had given me the answer to my prayers. I finally now was learning how to control the forces that had pretty well buffeted me at will. The faces that would show up, the manifestations, the terrifying sense of a presence. I was learning now how to weave around myself a white light of protection that gave me a sense of peace and security. I was learning how to meditate at a deeper level using the techniques, by the way, that are virtually identical to those now being promoted in the contemplative prayer movement in the church, practicing yoga and learning now how to gain a mastery over these forces that I had received no answer to, not from the Catholic nuns in the school I went to or from the so-called priests in our Episcopal church who were, it turns out, more involved in the occult than I ever knew. And through these people in Silva Mind Control, Dr. Stan, I was introduced to my personal spirit guide. Of course, they didn't call them spirit guides then, they probably still don't. This was my wise person, my counselor, my friend, whom I invited into my laboratory. And when I was told that we would need this counselor who would come and work with us at a psychic level to give us information and to help us produce good effect and positive healing in the lives of people around us, I thought, what better counselor could I possibly have than Jesus Christ? After all, I was a Christian. I'd accepted the Lord as my personal Savior my freshman year in college. I had asked him to come into my life. Somebody shared the four spiritual laws with me. And I knew on the basis of the Word of God that if I died that moment, that I would go to be with the Lord. Dr. Stan, everything about this Jesus seemed so right. When he manifested in this special psychic laboratory that I created in the silence, this quiet, meditative place that we were taught to go into using the same kind of techniques, very similar to first-level hypnosis induction techniques, similar to the kinds of techniques used in the guided imagery visualization practices now introduced and which have been introduced in the churches for many, many years now. I saw this being who looked like every picture of Jesus I'd ever seen. And I thought, how wonderful, it's true. Jesus said he stands at the door and knocks. I opened the door, and here he is. And, of course, so was Sarah Bernhardt. I was a theater major, not that I could act my way out of a paper stack. But I thought, well, I could use some acting tips, so I invited Sarah Bernhardt. She actually showed up, wooden leg and all. And I was convinced now, Dr. Stan, that I was on my way to doing something positive. Now, as I was working with Silva Mind Control and practicing now yoga, because I was getting involved in that as well, something very popular in the Christian realm today, I was also introduced to a woman in Mexico City who had been for some 40 years or more at the time, Dr. Stan, doing astonishing things. This woman was one of the few genuine psychic surgeons in the world, documented extensively by some of the top researchers in the field, Andre Puharich, Stanley Krippner, Alberto Villoldo, many other researchers who were not easily duped. And this woman, Dr. Stan, would go into a trance state sitting in front of a simple altar in the slums of Mexico City, an altar that was covered with flowers, with weird packages right wrapped up in bells, with jars of flowers and roses, with a crucifix and a picture of Jesus. And then, of course, there was also the statue of Hermanito Cuauhtémoc, the Aztec prince who claimed to be the spirit who was coming back to work these miraculous healings and cures through Pachita. She would sit down. We would begin to pray the Lord's Prayer. She would go into a full trance state, and someone else would come and take possession of her. She was a full trance medium. And this spirit would come, Dr. Stan, and do astonishing things. You're a medical surgeon, and I know, as I've shared my story with you and our audience in the past, I can almost feel the eyebrows raising, because I'd be raising them myself. This woman would take the rusty hunting knife and, in the power of this spirit, would literally cut open the patient lying on a cot with no more benefit of antiseptic than a bottle of new alcohol that was opened and splattered around, no more anesthesia than taking a few deep breaths and relaxing, the patient totally awake. And Dr. Stan, all I can tell you is I had my hands in it. I assisted personally in over 400 operations, because this medium, when I met her, it was after the surgeries. She was sitting on a cot, puffing on a cigarette, her arms crusted in dried blood. We got in there too late the first time I went there to see the operations. And she looked at me and took my hand, and she said, "You're a medium, aren't you?" Now, that was a term I'd never used for myself, but somehow it seemed to fit. And she told me to continue my studies with Silva Mind Control, to come back the next week, and that she would begin my training. And I went for 14 months, Dr. Stan, assisted personally in over 400 operations. I saw cataracts removed. with the woman sitting there with her eye wide open as a bottle of alcohol is poured into the eye without a moment of pain or flinching on her part. Some kind of a scum is peeled off, and the woman is bound up, her eye bound up. She's carried out. The next week she comes back. The cataract is gone. The doctor can't figure out what happened. A man who had an inoperable brain tumor lying on the cot on a plank that was brought in especially for this, because this was a different kind of operation. His skull, Dr. Stan, literally cut open. I know how this sounds. I know how this sounds. I would have thought I was insane or lying as well if I'd heard this story as well. All I can tell you is that this man's skull was cut open. My hands were on either side of the skull. I could feel the hands inside there through the bone. As Pachita was wiggling around and pulled out a stench of a tumor. The man's eyes crossed as we were speaking. I was holding his hand. I was speaking to him, and he's telling me, I can't tell you how weird this is. I can feel his hands inside my head. What is this? What is this? And then when his eyes crossed, he was really freaking out because he couldn't see straight anymore, literally. And Hermanito said, well, that certainly won't do. And he sticks his hand back in the man's skull, wiggles around, and the man's eyes straighten up. He was bound up. Months later, when I went back and checked on him, and over a year after that, when I went back and did some research and was checking on him, the man's tumor was completely gone. The doctors had no explanation. Dr. Stan, I saw what I could only explain and understand as miracles. And the point is this, Dr. Stan, my experience told me that this had to be from God. Everything that I had experienced in my early years with the presence of the beings, with the door slamming, with the frightening phenomena at Wesleyan College in Macon, Georgia, and at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, all of the fearsome manifestations and the gruesome things that would sit on the side of my bed, all of that was driven away as I would weave this white light around myself. And now, practicing yoga, doing the hatha yoga, the meditation yoga, the mantra yoga, which is such an integral part of contemplative prayer today, my experience said this was from God. And you know, the frightening thing today, Dr. Stan, is how now, I believe in fulfillment of the word of God and prophecy, you see now that millions of people are yearning, are seeking for that experience that gives them a sense of the transcendent, a passion for that immediate transcendent experience of God. And people don't much care, certainly at least according to Newsweek magazine that came out with an article in 2005 on the subject, cover article called Spirituality in America, where it said that millions of people now are embracing a desperate search for a deeper understanding and relationship with God. And whatever it takes to get that experience, they are willing to do it. And this isn't just in the Christian perspective. The pagans, the neo-pagans, the Wiccans, even the Satanists are experiencing a tremendous burgeoning. The Muslims and the Sufis are experiencing great resurgence and interest in devotion to God. The Buddhists certainly as well are experiencing that through the meditation techniques. But what has really been unnerving for me and for others of us, Dr. Stan, and I know you yourself as well, you've been speaking about this and trying to warn your audience for a very long time, is that there is a desperate danger in basing what you believe about God on your experience taken over and above the inerrant word of God, which is no longer something that's even believed in an awful lot of churches.
And I think that's really, really what it's all about. Everybody wants to experience God. Everybody wants a supernatural experience, as if somehow that's going to draw us closer to God. But that supernatural experience in truth may be actually dragging us away from God and, of course, misleading us dangerously. Go right ahead, Joanna.
You know, the thing I think, Dr. Stan, that made the difference for me in my leaving the occult was the fact that more than anything else, I wanted to know the truth. Back in 1972 now, I guess it would have been in 73, I'd been working with the medium for 14 months. I had decided that this was what I was devoting my life to. I had decided that these experiences were so wonderful, and the joy of seeing people healed and feeling that my life was worth something and had value was so overwhelming that I determined that I was going to devote my life to that. But there was someone in my life who kept doing the most annoying thing, saying, "Look, Johanna, I know your experience is astonishing. I know that you are convinced and totally believe because of your experience now that this is from God. But how do you know? Is there any source of absolute truth against which you can test your experience? Against which you can compare the two and say, you know what? This is valid and blessed of God, and no, this is dangerous and I've been deceived. On what basis can you tell?" And that is one of the most important questions, I think, that Christians, especially those who say or think or would like to think that they take the Bible seriously, would be asking themselves. Because if there is no source, Dr. Stan, of absolute truth against which we can compare our experience, then on what basis are we going to be able to discern what is from God and what isn't? If we can't learn at this stage, in the end times, when the Lord Jesus Christ himself warned us in Matthew 24 and in numerous other places, verse after verse after verse, warning us not to be deceived, warning us to be on the alert, because our adversary the devil prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour, 1 Peter 5:8. The thing is, we have been so completely undiscerning that I'm afraid that most of the churches I'm looking at it is right now looking more like a nice steamy plate of lamb chops that has already been half devoured than it is like the flock of the Lord Jesus Christ, because we have totally ignored God's command to be on the alert. You know, you're seeing it in every direction. The emerging church, for example, Dr. Stan, and I know you've done numerous programs on the issue of the emerging church now. The church that is seeking to minister, supposedly, to the younger generation, to be relevant, to fill the void of the empty ritual and the old-fashioned way of worshiping and the old supposed orthodoxy that is no longer relevant for today. And there are those in the ministry, and understandably, who are seeking relevant ways of ministering to the young people today. And what we have seen in their yearning to do so, and in the correlation between that and the overwhelming, desperate need to experience something, that swing back from the pendulum when back in 1966, we had the old arid theology that told us that God was dead. Well, God wasn't dead. What was dead was the old form of doing things, the old church structure.
Hold that thought there. We'll be back in just a moment with Johanna. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Johanna is pointing out the fact that so many people today want to experience God. They're looking for some sort of a supernatural experience to know that it's true. And of course, rather than sticking to the scriptures and what it says in the scriptures and learning about God that way, and now of course we want something, wouldn't it be nice if each of us could have that supernatural experience? The only trouble is, can we be sure it's coming from God and not from the other dimension? And one of the biggest problems is, Johanna, that most people, most Christians today, do not realize that we live in one dimension, but there is another dimension there, a spiritual dimension, and there really are beings that transcend from one dimension to the other and can, of course, encounter us. And, of course, they are deceiving. They are trying to lure us away from the truth. So you pick up the story there.
Well, the thing is, Dr. Stan, not only are they trying to lure us from the truth, but because there has been such an attack on the reliability and the validity of the Word of God as source of absolute truth, that concept now is anathema even to many pastors and many leaders in the church, as we'll see in a moment. What is absolutely terrifying is that now practices that once easily from Scripture could have been identified as being something God would not bless have now been brought into the church, and we're being told by people, for example, like Tilden Edwards, who's the founder of Shalem Institute, one of the biggest institutes teaching contemplative prayer, that what makes a particular practice Christian isn't its source, but its intent. So what they're telling us now, Dr. Stan, is it doesn't matter if you want to bring in yoga, if you want to bring in ancient Buddhist meditative practices, mantra yoga, if you want to bring in ancient occult techniques of pranayama and deep breathing, if you want to bring in any form of ESP or occultism into the church, what matters is your intent, not the source of the practice. And I will tell you, at that point, you are seeing the fulfillment of Scripture about even the elect being deceived, because what you have done now is totally eradicate and remove any possibility of testing the spirits to see whether they're from God. How on earth are you going to do that if all you've got to rely on is your intent? And really, when we started to see the swing, Dr. Stan, was in the 60s, because at that point you had out in one of the monasteries there, Catholic monastery, St. Joseph Abbey, a Father Thomas Keating who was sitting there in Massachusetts, and they were very deeply involved in many of these practices, all of these things of contemplative prayer, meditation techniques, deep breathing techniques, have all been a part of the Catholic Church for centuries. It was brought in, actually, by the early Desert Fathers. And the early Desert Fathers were the small groups, isolated groups of men and women, monks, nuns, who in the early Middle Ages would gather themselves off in a desperate and sincere yearning and desire to come close to God. And off in the Middle East, in the desert, there, they would gather in the small groups and practice whatever technique they could find to give them an experience with God. And what was a little unnerving then is it didn't much matter to them. It was a time of experimenting, and they didn't have many guidelines at the time, and it didn't much matter to them what kind of technique. So that when you had the meditative techniques coming through Alexandria in Egypt, picking up the Hellenistic and Roman influences, the mystery religions, the Gnostic tendencies and approaches and belief systems, the ancient Hindu practices, the meditation techniques that were an integral part of the yoga system, they simply said, oh, just like Tilden Edwards, what makes a particular practice Christian is not its source, but its intent. Okay, these techniques of contemplative prayer and meditation are being used by the Buddhists, or later on the Buddhists, and the Hindus and the mystery religions, but we are going to use it to glorify Christ. And then in the 60s, Father Thomas Keating brought in a Zen master into their Trappist monastery saying, you know, if we're having these great religious experiences here, maybe there's something now that we could use to deepen it. And they brought in the great Zen master, Roshi Sasaki, to lead a retreat at the Abbey. And they had an incredible time, powerful spiritual techniques. And they said, ah, now, can we find a Christian tradition?
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Johanna Michelson, and we're talking about really first the history of the extension of these mystical approaches into this Catholic Abbey. So pick the story up there. These people are searching for a means of experiencing God. There is a Catholic unit, and they've even brought in somebody from the Eastern mystical religions. And how are we going to experience Christ? Go ahead.
And so they had this wonderful experience with the Zen master, Roshi Suzaki. And then Father Thomas Keating, the abbot of the abbey there, said to his Trappist brother, Father William Menninger, look, see if we can find a Christian perspective to this. And sure enough, one day in 1974, he comes across a dusty old copy of a 14th century guide to contemplative meditation called The Cloud of Unknowing. And it draws on the work of one of the writings, as well as on the writings of St. John of the Cross and Teresa de Avila. And they began teaching a form of, quote, Christian meditation that really has now grown into a worldwide phenomenon, Dr. Stan, and it's known as centering prayer, which really is the lifeblood of the emerging church. That emerging church, which is seeking to minister to the young people, the young generation, that is bent on experience. So now here, they have the perfect venue for bringing these people into what they consider an experience with God in a Christian perspective. The only problem is, with these centering techniques, is that they're realizing, and they knew it even then, that these were identical to the Buddhist perspective, to the Buddhist approach that the Zen master Roshi Suzaki was teaching them in their monastery. And it was inevitable that they would find those similarities because they have the roots in the same place. The contemplative prayer now is focusing on basically one thing, a philosophy and a theology that says God is bigger than just this personal being. God is a force. God is all around us. We are one with God, and what we need to do is to get back and remember that we are a part of the divine, we are in paradise, we've just forgotten it. And through this practice of centering prayer, in which we sit in a quiet meditative state and take a word, a single word which we can say over and over and over and over again.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Johanna is describing the techniques that are being used, certainly within the emerging church, the centering prayer technique that is being used, and taking one word and repeating it over and over and over again. We come into almost an alpha state, into a hypnotic situation where our minds are open to the beings from the other dimension to come in and take control. Pick the story up there.
And of course, Dr. Stan, they would take grave exception to phrasing it that way, that we're opening our minds to other beings to take control, and yet that is exactly what is happening. Contemplative prayer isn't biblical prayer at all. It's a type of mystical meditation that is designed to put you in an altered state of consciousness. It's something that's going beyond thought, and it's seeking to provide an experiential union with whatever. They're calling it God. But the question is it God? And you know, as you're looking, Dr. Stan, at these practices, the contemplative prayer, the deep breathing techniques that now are being promoted by Rick Warren in his purpose-driven book, you know, do the breath prayer where you're breathing in Jesus, and you can say the word over and over again, or Jesus, have mercy on me, a sinner, and you're breathing out the negativity and the fear and all the stuff that you don't want to be a part of your soul. And you're doing this until you're feeling and sensing that experience with the divine. And what you've done, Dr. Stan, is now left yourself open in neutral to something very, very different. And how do we know? All right, let's get back to what the Word of God says. The Word of God, as we are looking at that, gives us some pretty clear guidelines about the influences from the East. It gives us some very clear direction about what God has to say about those who were bringing in the practices of other gods. You know, in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 6, for example, it tells us that, and here, let me find the passage for you exactly. It says, "You have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because you were filled with influences from the east, and they are soothsayers like these, like the Philistines." Isaiah chapter 2, verse 6. And here we are now bringing in influences from the east and saying these things are going to be blessed from God because we're so sincere. Actually, Dr. Stan, I think one of the things the church needs to take hold of is that sincerity does not act as a kind of magical protection against demonic intrusion or deception. There isn't a single verse anywhere in the Bible that assures us our sincerity alone is going to protect us or guarantee us automatic immunity from spiritual deception. And that is something I think that the church simply doesn't want to deal with and will not acknowledge. They feel if we're sincere, if we are moving into an area that makes sense to us, then on what basis are we going to say that this isn't from God? People like Leonard Sweet, for example, also one of the leaders in this movement, a futurist and a professor, who's written a couple of books now that I found rather unnerving on many levels, Quantum Spirituality, for example, a postmodern apologetic, in which he's talking about the trends of the future. And there isn't an occultist or a New Ager that he doesn't praise and hold in high esteem here, from David Spangler, a metaphysician, to Matthew Fox, one of the great heretics that even the Catholic Church has recognized as a heretic. And he's talking about how really we, unfortunately as Christians, have kept in good repair prejudices against what may be God's other sign language of the fourth dimension, also known as the fourth psychology. And he's saying, really, what a shame, because here you've got millions of people across the world who know that there is this other dimension, extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, the mind's ability to alter matter, the out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, remote viewing, all the things that you're seeing, for example, on Medium or these other programs on TV that are so popular now. And he's saying, yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that the church, bearing the stamp of lunacy, is remaining antagonistic or indifferent, even broaching a subject about which everyone seems to know something. He said millions of people are involved in occult experiences, but oh, how unfortunate and how tragic that the church is ignoring it and turning its back on it and is saying, oh, we don't dare go anywhere near that. It's too frightening. But he's saying, look, the postmodern culture is very superstitious. 73% are avoiding walking under a ladder, and they'll step into a street to avoid doing that. 1 in 4 believe in ghosts. 1 in 6 communicate with a deceased. 1 in 4 communicate telepathically with another person. 1 in 10 claim to have seen a ghost or felt its presence. 1 in 7 claim to have seen a UFO. 1 in 2 believes in ESP. 1 in 4 follows astrology. How many people are checking their astrological chart to see whether they should get out of bed in the morning? And he's saying the church must not sweep mysticism under the rug. The paranormal is normal. Extrasensory perception, ESP, is real, not imagined or schizophrenic. Mystical experiences happen. And he's right. Mystical experiences do happen. The question is, how do you tell the difference between what is of God and what isn't? And people, as you're listening and sorting this out, if you are going to go testing your theology only by it feels right, I had a wonderful experience, then you need to know, in accordance with the Word of God, you have left yourself open to some frightening things, because God has a very dim view of those who practice the kinds of things taught by the contemplative prayer, going into an altered state of consciousness, seeking to become one with the divine, seeking to develop psychic and mystical abilities and powers, seeking to communicate with the dead. And you know, Dr. Stan, as I was thinking about a lot of these things around the time when I was involved with Pachita and practicing yoga, and this person in my life, my sister, kept asking me the question, Johanna, you're having these beautiful experiences. You believe you're seeing Jesus. You believe as you're chanting your mantra and as you're communing now and going into your deep trance state that you're following God and that what you're experiencing is from God. How do you know? And I had to admit, Dr. Stan, all I had to go on was, it feels right. I had nothing else. It feels right. And then I reached a point where I said, well, what if I've been deceived? What if these mystical experiences I'm having through ESP and psychic phenomena, through the practice of yoga, which I was convinced was something that was helping me commune with the living God. I used it to worship the Lord, even as these people now who are writing these books on Christian yoga believe that they're doing. Not understanding that it's an oxymoron. There is no such thing as Christian yoga, any more than there is any such thing as Christian Buddhism or Christian Sufism and Muslims or Christian Wiccans. And yet, I'm looking at stacks of documentation right now. You can download it on the internet about the Christian Buddhists, the Christian Muslims, and the Christian Wiccans, and the Christian Luciferians. Because they will not test their experiences against the Word of God. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 9, states the following, and I think, church, it's important to listen to. The Lord was giving us a warning, and Moses was speaking to the people of Israel before they were to enter the promised land, and he said this, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the abominable things of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, which was a vile form of child sacrifice practiced by the Canaanites in those days. I suggest to you that while we may not see human sacrifice as much, at least in this country, to the god Moloch or Lucifer or Chemosh or Tanit, that the God self is every bit as much of a deity and a divinity, certainly in God's perspective. Self is as much of a false god as any of these other deities, and that when we practice abortion and wipe innocent life from our life because it's inconvenient, that is as much human sacrifice to the God self as anything spoken about here in the Old Testament. But it was interesting to me, Dr. Stan, to see what God included with human sacrifice, or one who uses divination, astrology, the tarot cards, the I Ching that Carl Jung was so fond of and wrote a foreword to one of the translations for, the Ouija board. There are hundreds of thousands of different forms of divination, of seeking through occult hidden means information about the future. Or one who practices witchcraft, sorry Harry Potter and sorry Hermione, witchcraft is something called abomination before the living God. And he doesn't differentiate between the black ones, the white ones, the red ones, the polka-dotted ones, the really creepy, scary ones that you'll see in the Harry Potter movie coming out in the next few weeks, or the wonderful, cute little ones that are going to Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. All of them are labeled abomination here. Or one who interprets omens, the superstition. A lot of horses are running around to this day in their stocking feet because farmers keep putting their shoes on the door to keep the luck from running out. Or a sorcerer. Again, sorry, Harry Potter. One who casts, and by the way, sorcery comes from the word pharmakia, the use of hallucinogenic drugs to put you in the same kind of altered state of consciousness which the contemplative prayer movement is achieving through the use of a mantra, through the use of the meditation techniques taught by the Buddhists and picked up by the ancient desert fathers and translated into the church, and then introduced even to the evangelical church through Richard Foster and Thomas Merton, whose one goal in life before he was electrocuted in India on a pilgrimage there to learn more about Hinduism and Buddhism was to become the best Buddhist he could possibly become, or one who casts a spell, or a medium. Oh, that would make me sit up, Dr. Stan. I was a medium. A medium is simply a go-between, someone who thinks they can communicate with the other world, the world of the dead, and indeed they can. The question is, with whom are they communicating? Or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord, and because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out from before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. For those nations which you shall dispossess, listen to those who practice witchcraft and to diviners. But as for you, child of God, the Lord of God, your God, has not allowed you to do so. You know, I have to wonder, Dr. Stan, as I read passage after passage, do not learn the way of the heathen. Do not become involved with those who practice witchcraft and listen to diviners. Isaiah chapter 8, when they say to you, let us consult the mediums and the wizards who chirp and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? He says, the law and the testimony, if they don't speak according to this word, the revealed word of the living God, it's because they have no dawn in them. And Dr. Stan, that statement right there is a vile, politically incorrect, horrendously offensive one to an awful lot of pastors, big name pastors in the church, who now, because of their practices, are saying, look, if we are having the same experiences as the Buddhists and the Sufis and the Muslims and the Wiccans and Neo-Pagans, if we, through the same techniques of contemplative meditation, taking a word, whether it's Jesus, 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 or Om Mani Padme Om, or Om over and over and over again, if we're contacting what we believe, surely, must be the same source of divine, then on what basis are you, you narrow-minded, Bible-thumping fundamentalist, going to sit there and say to me that what I'm experiencing isn't from God? And what's happening, Dr. Stan, as we, because of the open door now to all of these experiences which flooded in with the Beatles in the 60s, the drug culture, they're bringing in Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and the transcendental meditation, the flooding in of all the seeking after the mystical and the meditative and the experience that we are all so desperate for and longing for. What is it that's happening? Why are we seeing this? I believe it's because we are looking at the fulfillment of Scripture. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we are told about one who is coming, one who will be rising up now. And we are told in 2 Thessalonians 2 not to be deceived. After a while, you get really sensitive to the fact that Scripture time and time and time again says to Christians, wake up! Stop being deceived. Test the spirits to see whether they're from God. Let no one in any way deceive you. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. For it will not come first until the apostasy comes. That man of lawlessness will be revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. That is, it says in verse 9, the one who's coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish. And now listen to this, audience, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence, so that they will believe what is false. People, that is what's happening today. Today we are seeing a flood of people who, because of these mystical experiences, are feeling, believing, experiencing that they are one with God, that they have that divine goodness inside of them that they have now tapped into, that higher self spoken about by the Hindus and the mystics for generations and for millennia. And once they've experienced that, when the Antichrist comes and says, I am God, we won't be taken by surprise. There are countless of Antichrists, little gods running around. And when one comes displaying great power and says, I am God, they're going to say, yes, you are. He's just godier than the rest of us.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Johanna. Well, Johanna, I agree with everything you've said. You know, the thing is that the Bible is so simple. It's not complex at all. People don't want anything simple. They want to make it complex. They want to feel it. They want to experience it. And yet, of course, Christianity is intellectual. It is not spiritual. It is not feeling good. It's not how you feel about what you believe. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have a web page or any way that people could get in touch with you if they wanted more information?
Dr. Sten, I can be contacted through my publisher, Harvest House. But, you know, they will get it all mailed to me, and I'd be happy to correspond through that. But, you know, the one thing I want to end with, Dr. Sten, is people be alert. Because what you are doing when you go and cling to these other practices is very much like the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10, who decided they were going to come to God their way, never mind what the Bible had to say, and they offered strange fire before the Lord, which he'd not commanded them, and the Lord executed them for it. People of God, we do have a personal relationship with the living God. It isn't, Dr. Sten, I believe, just intellectual, because we come to God with our whole heart as well as our whole mind. But if you are judging and gauging your belief in what God is, in who God is, in who Jesus Christ, his Son, is, based on your experience, and an occultically based experience at that, then you run the danger of following after another Jesus, another spirit, another gospel, and worse, a danger of hearing the most horrendous words anybody could hear that Jesus spoke about when he told us to beware of the false prophets in Matthew 7, who come to you in sheep's clothing, pretending to be good, pretending to be godly, pretending to be sweet, pretending to be men of God, like Brian McLaren, one of the 25 top evangelicals, according to Time magazine a couple of years ago, who says, hell is the worst advertising God ever had, and shouldn't we be thinking of Jesus more like Mahatma Gandhi or like Martin Luther King rather than this exclusivist? At that point, you will hear the words of the Lord saying, depart from me, you workers of iniquity. I never knew you, and I don't care how many times you called me or prophesied or cast out demons. If you're following another Jesus whom you've conjured up or allowed in because of a cult-based experience, and you have not tested it according to the Word of God, you've got the wrong one, and he will not save you.
You are out of time. Good night. God bless. Well, our guest has been Johanna Michaels. And Johanna, thank you so very much for being with us this evening, and I hope we get you to come back again. I think everything you say is so true, and there is such spiritual deception all across our land, all across the world today. So, Johanna is gone, and so this is the time when I really need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you'd like to get a copy of this evening's tape, and remember, we do talk through the breaks. Why, they're available through Radio Liberty, as all of our tapes are, and we have many tape sets. We have Cindy Johanna's book, The Beautiful Side of Evil. We have our interviews with her, The Supernatural. And if you'd like to get other interviews with Johanna, they are available through Radio Liberty, and you'll learn and benefit so much from them. So remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. One of the most dangerous issues before the church today is this phenomenon of the secret. The book, the DVD, pushed by Rhonda Burns, it is an occult practice, and millions of Americans are adopting the law of attraction and dooming themselves to eternal removal, exclusion from God's kingdom. We have a four-tape set entitled The Secret Behind the Secret. It's available in tape or CD. We hope any of you will want to get that. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on Satanism and Deliverance, a four-tape set on Aleister Crowley, a four-tape set on the wisdom of Malachi Martin. All of these things will begin to introduce you to this other dimension. And it's not imaginary. It is real. And you want to avoid it under any and all circumstances. Certainly, we hope that many of you will want to get my talk, Brotherhood of Darkness. It's available in DVD or VHS. And, of course, you'll want to get the book and have that to document what I'm telling you. You want to get the talk, The Forbidden Secret. And, of course, the syllabus that goes with that, which you can, and then we certainly would want to get our talk on the Iraq, the Untold Story. It's the history of all the wars of the last century, and it comes with an excellent syllabus. And that syllabus gives you all sorts of documentation. You'd want to get Hidden Agenda. Goes into how they're poisoning us and our children with water fluoridation. You'd certainly want to get my talk on the financial tsunami, which is about to engulf our nation and destroy the monetary well-being of so many of our people. And that, of course, comes with an excellent syllabus. And if you'd like more information, go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Or please, of course, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, to get copies of the tape of this program, or I'd like to learn about getting the other items we mentioned, 1-800-544-8927. And then, Chris, we want you to understand, although we talk a lot about politics, although we talk a lot about history, and we talk a lot about medicine, and we talk a lot about financial matters, we feel this is all really spiritual in its foundation. And if you haven't, of course, read my little pamphlet on the history of money, it goes into the man who really began to begin modern banking practices with interest, a man named Sir Francis Bacon, who was part of this mystical group of the Rosicrucians. If you'd like to know more about them, the two DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, and Riddles in Stone. That's The Secret Mystery of America's Beginnings and Riddles in Stone. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. So until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.